Good morning, New Hope. I don't know what little boy or girl was praying for snow this weekend, but God showed up in a big way. Glad you could be here with us, or maybe you're joining us online. Glad you could be viewing that way as well. If we haven't met before, my name's Kyle Denny. I'm one of the pastors on staff. I get to oversee the student ministries, the middle school and the high school ministries. Pastor Mark's on vacation, and he'll be back next week. And so today we're going to be in 1 Corinthians 10. If you want to crack a Bible and flip there, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 23. We'll also put the verses on the screen too, so that's there. While you're turning to 1 Corinthians 10, I got two announcements for you. The first one is just that our children's ministry is doing their special Christmas celebration in 2 weeks. It's two Sundays from now on the 14th. They're going to do some special music, special worship, special snacks. It'll be a great time. If you send your kids to children's ministry, there's not anything different you have to do. They just want you to be aware that it's going to be a more pumped up event for that day. And then the second thing is, since I'm the youth pastor, I want to take this moment to talk to the middle school and high school students. If you're in here and I don't know you, man, I just think you're awesome. I've been doing youth ministry for 15 years, and I think it's really hard to be a middle school and a high schooler. And so I think you got a lot going for you. If you're not plugged into community somewhere, I would just highly encourage you to find community somewhere. If you want to come to our youth group, we have amazing leaders. We got some awesome students that will challenge your faith, that will help grow your faith. But maybe it's somewhere else, and that's okay. I would just encourage you, get in community. That's one of the best ways that we grow, adults too, parents too, get in community. That is what's really going to help us rub against each other and sharpen each other, is in community. So we are going to be, if you have questions about youth group, come talk to me afterwards. We got details. You can fill out a Connect card or come talk to me. If you're online, you can go on our website. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 23 to chapter 11, verse 1. I'm going to read this out in front of us so you see the bulk, and then we're going to start chipping away at it. It's written, "All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. Eat anything that's sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience' sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you want to go, eat anything that's set before you without asking questions for conscience' sake. But if someone says to you, 'This is meat sacrificed to idols,' do not eat it, for the sake of the one who informs you and for conscience' sake. I mean not your own conscience, but the other man's, for why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I slandered concerning this for which I give thanks? Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, so that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ." Years ago, I was at Funtime Adventure Park. It was in Okemos. If you've been around the area for a while, you might remember it. They had go-karts, they had miniature golf. They're since closed now. But I was there, and we were doing some go-karting with some friends. And I don't want to brag or anything, but I destroyed them. Like, no one could get even close to me in that go-kart race. And my friends afterwards came up to me, and they're like, "It's weird. Whenever we got close to you, it's like our go-karts powered down. Like, we couldn't get anywhere near you." And I said, okay, excuses, right? That's not a thing. But some pieces started falling in place. I had reconnected with the person who was the controller of the go-karts. I knew him when he was a middle schooler and he was a high schooler. And he had this big grin, this big smirk on his face while my friends were talking to me. And so I went up to him and I'm like, "Hey, that's not a thing, is it?" And he said, "No, I slowed down their go-karts." And he showed me, he could individually control different carts. They had regulators or governors or something. And so literally whenever someone got close to me, he would just turn it down and they would fall back. He wanted me to win, which is a bummer because I could have won without his help, right? It took the bragging rights away. If we boil this passage down, If we get down to the bones of what this is saying, that's actually what Paul is expecting of us. He expects us to be at the controls and to slow things down that something else would take the lead. In order for our love to go forth, sometimes we might need to dial down our rights and our freedom. Now, what does that mean, right? Where we're going today, what does that mean? What's at stake with that? How do I do that? What does that mean? What's at stake? How do I do that? This 1 Corinthians is a letter written to the Corinthian church. And the Corinthians come from a very messy culture. They've been raised in a society that says that the ultra-rich should have open disdain. They should have ferocity against the poor in their area, to the poverty. They come from a culture that applauds, that celebrates, that worships cult prostitution. In fact, Corinth has two harbors, and it's known for sea captains arriving there to spend all of their money on sexual immorality. That was encouraged, that was worshiped and celebrated. They're known for a ferocious, competitive nature, for being divisive, for having these tribes around them. And what we see is that the Corinthians' culture follows them into the church. You look at the Lord's Supper and you have the ultra-wealthy showing open disdain for the poor. You have the Corinthians flaunting sexual immorality. There's some things that they're doing that even the non-believers are kind of tilting their head being like, that's messed up. Even we wouldn't do that. And yet no one in the church is confronting them. Laissez-faire about it. What we see is that they're choosing the different Bible teachers, the different apostles, whether it's Peter or Paul or Apollos, and they're forming tribes around them. They're being divisive and competitive, saying that that's our guy and our guy's better than your guy. It's kind of like when you're little, you're like, my dad can beat up your dad, but they're doing it with apostles, right? And it's stirring up division. It's stirring up controversy. Paul himself calls the Corinthian church people of the flesh. You see, their culture has followed them into the church. And it's a mess. But what I love is that Paul stays with them in the mess. He doesn't just church hop. He doesn't just ditch them and be like, well, at least I got Ephesus and Philippi. He hangs in there with them. He says in 1 Corinthians 1, I thank my God always concerning you for the grace of God which was given you in Christ Jesus. Things are messy. And Paul's not just over here condescending, you know, off to the side. He's showing them love. He says, I thank you guys. Yes, you're a mess. But I thank my God for you always. He doesn't question their salvation. He's going to hold them accountable to their salvation. And so he writes 1 Corinthians out of love. He needs to correct some stuff for their good. And so he's going to call them out on a whole mess of things. He's also going to answer a lot of questions they have. In 1 Corinthians 7, it says, now concerning the things about which you wrote. Apparently, they have some questions about how to do things or what it looks like or what it means. There's six spots in the letter where Paul says, now concerning. And each time, he seems to be addressing what they asked of him. Our passage falls into one of those questions. What the Corinthians are concerned about is, can they eat food that has been sacrificed to idols? Maybe not the most applicable to us, right? Kind of doubt that anyone at Thanksgiving sat down with their host and was like, oh, just got to double check. Is this sacrificed idol meat by chance? Nope, can't have any, right? It's maybe not as applicable to us with the issue with where we are. However, the principle and the way he applies the principle to the issue, it is gold. It is so good for us to see. Three ways that this idol food impacted the Corinthians. One would be the temples. There's all kinds of small g god temples in Corinth. You had Aphrodite, you had Poseidon, you had Zeus, you had Hermes, yada, yada, yada. It goes on and on. And all these small G temples would have these feasts, and it'd be a social occasion. People would invite other people, and they'd have food for the gods that they would sacrifice to, and then they'd also have food for themselves. And so one of the questions is, can we go to this temple and eat this idol food here? Well, leftover food then gets sold to the meat market. And so then people could go and they could buy leftover food from the temple, and that's where it's at. And then some people would host a family dinner and invite friends over, and they'd buy meat from the meat market from the temple, and you'd have idol food there. Or maybe they'd take it home from the temple. You have all these different ways, and the Corinthians want to know, is it okay for us to eat this meat that was served to idols? Paul shoots down the first option. If you look at chapter 8 all the way through our passage now, he's been addressing that first one, should we go to temples or not? He comes to the conclusion in chapter 10, verse 19. He says, what do I mean then that a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I do not want you to become sharers in demons. He says, absolutely not. This is off the table. He says, in that temple, when they're sacrificing this food to demons, yeah, there's one God. That is true. You got it right, Corinthians. There's one God, but they're sacrificing these things to demons. And I do not want you to be a partaker with that. That is off the limit. You can't have it. And then he's going to go into the next two nuances, the meat markets and the individual dinners. And he's got to explain it a little more. That's where the principle is going to start coming in play. Our passage starts off, all things are lawful. Man, it's really easy to make the Bible say whatever you want to say. All things are lawful. The Greek word there is all things are authorized, all things are permitted, all things are allowed. That is my new favorite life verse. All things are lawful until we look at the context, right? For the first 10 chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul has very clearly been showing them all things are not lawful. I was talking to Pastor Rich Bruce, and he said he likes to insert the word amoral into things. All amoral things are lawful. Things in which the Bible does not specifically categorize as sin or as righteousness. Things the Bible is indifferent towards. That would be reading this passage in context. Food is amoral. Look what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8. He says, food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do eat. On its own, food is not good and it is not bad. It's absent of morality. It depends on how we use it that's going to come into play. This is likely a quote, all things are lawful, from the Corinthians. They're likely kind of chanting this back and forth to each other in order to puff themselves up to say, we can do this because it's allowed. This is okay to do. It's permitted. And it's like Paul's at the controls of the go-kart and he's just turning down their speed. He says, yeah, all things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. This is a hard chunk of scripture because it tells you no, and nobody likes to be told no. A few weeks ago, my wife made pumpkin spice cinnamon rolls. And they were as good as they sound. They were amazing. And there were some leftover ones in the fridge. And one morning, I was trying to help get the kids corralled for school, and my stomach started rumbling. And I'm like, ooh, forgot breakfast. And I opened the fridge. Lo and behold, pumpkin spice cinnamon rolls. And my mouth started to water. And I took it out, and I was trying to hide it so the kids wouldn't see. And I put it on the counter, and I hear a mmm. And I turn around, and there's my wife looking at me. And we're at the stage in parenting where my kids can spell and they know as much Spanish as I know. And so for us to communicate, we can't really use words anymore. We have to use stares. Like, I'll ask them to do something and they won't hear me. But 10 rooms away behind a locked door, they will hear every word of whatever I'm saying to Chelsea. Well, after years of marriage, I've grown pretty good at understanding what these stares are saying. And she stared at me, and I knew immediately what she was saying. She was saying, "You strong man, you. You hardworking man. If you eat those cinnamon rolls, it will derail our morning. The kids will blow up, right? There will be chaos and bloodshed. They will say, well, Dad's eating those, and it will just derail the flow of our morning." And in that moment, I knew two things were true. One, I knew she was right. 100% I knew she was right. I knew that I didn't want her to be right. And so what flared up inside of me was anger. Why? Because no one likes to be told no. No one likes to be told what they should do. You ever have those situations where things are lawful, you're allowed to do it, you're permitted to do it, but the only one it's going to profit is you? We have to understand that word profitable in context. Paul repeats it twice. He says, all things are lawful, not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, not all things edify. Not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. As Christians, what he's saying is the measuring rod of what we do is not, can I do it? But is it profitable? Is it helpful? Does it build other people up? It's not specifically mentioned here, but Paul is talking about love of your neighbor. And what he's getting at is sometimes for our love to go forth, our rights and our freedoms have to be dialed down. They have to take a back seat. This doesn't mean that we can't ever seek our own good. It doesn't mean we can't ever enjoy our rights or our freedom. It just means it can't be the thing. It can't be the thing that we prioritize. Paul writes to another church in Philippi. He says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others." Did you catch that? We're to regard others as more important. He says, no, don't just look to your own interests, although that is allowed. Look to the interests of others. It doesn't mean we can't enjoy our rights or our freedom. It just means that it's not the thing that's meant to be prioritized. Paul has just laid out this principle that not all things edify, not all things are profitable. And now he's going to illustrate what that looks like. He starts talking about this sacrificed meat to idols. He says, "Eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you want to go, eat anything that's set before you without asking questions for conscience sake." Right? Paul's declaration is, idol meat is fine. You can eat it. You have that right. You have that freedom. Animals that have been sacrificed to small g gods, that have been sacrificed to demons, as soon as you take it out of that context and you put it anywhere else, it is the Lord's. It's still the Lord's. It doesn't matter what they intended for it. It is in the earth and it's God's. And he appeals to Psalm 24 to quote that, to back it up. The food belongs to Yahweh. And so he says, eat anything sold in the meat markets. We already said that these meat markets would get food from the temple, that they'd get the leftovers that they would then package up and sell. But they would also have a source of food somewhere else, that there'd be a butcher killing other animals for consumption, and it would be mixed at this meat market. Paul's whole point is going to be crucial, that they don't know which is which, that they don't know if it's from the temple, that it's idol meat, or if it's just butchered meat. Paul just says, go ahead and eat. And then the second scenario, they get a personal invitation to dinner. He says, go ahead and eat at that dinner. Dinners in that day were really important. That's how you grew your social stature. That's how you curried favors. That's how you moved up in the world. And these dinners meant something. Look at what, there's a Greek writer from the second century that records this. He says, nobody invites an enemy or unknown person to dinner. not even a slight acquaintance. A man must first, I take it, become a friend in order to share another's bowl and board. I often have heard people say, how much of a friend is he when he has neither eaten or drunk with us? There's an aspect of friendship, relational building, social capital that comes through these dinners. And Paul says, you have a right to go. You have the freedom to go. Go and don't ask questions. Enjoy it. Again, he's assuming the identity of the source of food is unknown. Is it from idols? Maybe. Maybe not. Don't make a big deal about it. Just eat it. But then he goes on to say, but if anyone says to you, this is meat sacrificed to idols, do not eat it. See, the idol food has not changed. They are still allowed to eat it. It is still the Lord's. It's still outside pagan, demonic ritual. But now the context has changed. Someone has brought up that this meat is sacrificed to idols. And there has been much ink spilled trying to figure out who that anyone is. Is it a believer? Is it someone that Paul would refer to as a weak believer or a strong believer? Is it a non-believer? Is it the host? Is it the butcher? Who is he talking about when he hypothetically says, if anyone raises this concern? Paul doesn't say. So we can't say with 100% confidence, but I would argue that it makes the most sense that this is a non-believer. Most likely, it's implied to be the host or the butcher at the market. What's going on is they know that Christians have an adversity to eating idol food. Christians aren't going to go to the temple to eat. They don't believe in a plethora of gods. They believe in one God. And so Paul gives them a hypothetical situation. If anyone, if a non-believer tries to warn a Christian about idol meat, you're to abstain from it. Why? Because the context has changed. He says, do not eat it for the sake of the one who informed you and for conscience sake. I mean not your own conscience, but the other man's. Sometimes for our love to go forth, our rights and our freedoms have to get dialed down. Instead of the Corinthians' actions being edifying and profitable, they're now going to be destructive. He says, it's not your conscience that I'm worried about, it's the other person's. It's for their sake that you shouldn't eat this meat. Something about knowing that it's idol meat has made it unprofitable. Now, I am a CPA, and one thing that I really loved when I was learning the trade was what they had to say about integrity. In accounting, the accountants believe in integrity by fact and by appearance. Fact is obviously, yes, you have to do what the law says. You should do what the law says. If you want to be a man of integrity, a woman of integrity, that's what you do. But then they go above that and they say, we actually want you to have integrity in appearance as well. We don't want you to do anything that even looks fishy. We want you to care about it that much. And that's really what's going on here. In fact, in actuality, the Corinthians are fine. This food is fine to eat. In appearance, they are not. In appearance is where the rub comes in. For someone to go out of their way and say, hey, that's actually meat that was sacrificed to another god. I know you might care about that. I just want you to know. And then for you to chow down on it anyways is not for their good. It's for their destruction. The believer is communicating that idolatry is actually not that big a deal. On the other hand, if they would not eat the meat, that would declare something about their God. That would show the other person something about their God. Paul says, for why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I slandered concerning that for which I give thanks? He essentially says, play this out in your mind. For what reason, for what purpose should my freedom be judged by another's conscience? They're either going to be affirmed in their idolatry or they're going to slander me. They're going to think that I'm a hypocrite, that I say one thing and I do another. Either one is going to hurt and destroy their witness to them. You see there's something even more important at stake than their rights and their freedom. Paul says, whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. This is a pretty popular memory verse, but I think we often use this in the wrong context. The Corinthians are being instructed to give up some of their freedom. The Corinthians are to give up eating and drinking to the glory of God. It's not just about eating and drinking and giving thanks. It's not less than that. That's a part of doing things to God's glory. But it's the circumstance of why and how they do it that brings glory to God. That is what is at stake. We are called to love our neighbors, yes and amen. That is important. But there's actually something deeper that happens when we love our neighbors, and it's God's glory. Now, I occasionally listen to this older theologian, and I want to put his quote up on the screen for us. He said last week, Senior Pastor Mark Kring, I said older, not old. He's literally older than me, okay? Just clearing that up. He said, ultimately, this is what shocks most people. His, God's, perfect purposes are about his glory. I thought that's perfect. Because I think that's really hard for us to understand, especially if we don't come from a churched background. Glory can be a type of Christianese word for me. It can be a non-word that I have a hard time picturing. Like, did you notice that we sang about God's glory in the songs this morning, or did you just gloss right over it because it doesn't have a picture attached to it? What is the glory of God? Are we just kind of disposable? Like, God's really doing this for his glory, and we're just this byproduct that gets to come along for it? Are we a means to an end if God cares about his glory? The word for glory is the Greek word doxa. It refers to the honor which is attributed, the splendor which characterizes a person or a thing. I like going back to Moses' encounter with God. Moses asks God, can I see your glory? And God says, well, first I got to put you in a cleft so I don't destroy you, because it would destroy you. And then he says, I will let all of my goodness go before you. Moses asked about God's glory, and he said, my goodness will go before you. And then he says, I will declare my name. He's not just saying his covenantal name. He is declaring his essence, the radiance of who he is, the splendor, the brilliance of who God is goes before Moses. And it's God's way of showing him his glory. If we jump to the New Testament, when Jesus finds out that Lazarus is falling ill, he says, but when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. What do we get to see with Lazarus' death? We get to see God's heart. We get to see Jesus crying for his friend, weeping. We get to see his anger at sin and the destruction that sin causes. We get to see God's power. We get glimpses of his goodness, that he reverses death, that death cannot hold a candle to God's power. We get to see restoration. We get to see reunion as Lazarus, who was separated from his friends and family, is now reunited. It's for God's glory. Jesus is glorified by it. We understand God better. We see the essence of who he is better because of that miracle. The splendor, the radiance, the brilliance, the glory of God is always for our good. The glory of me will eventually be for someone else's bad. They will be worse off if I'm focused on my glory in my reign. That's never the case with God. Paul says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I think if we just sat in that verse and we sat in it in context, that's got some power to it. And if we think about retirement, not everyone here is retired, but all of us are probably aspiring to be retired at some point. If we took our retirement, what does it look like to do that to the glory of God? It's not just being thankful. It's not less than that. We have rights. We have freedom. We are allowed to enjoy our retirement. We're not allowed to prioritize it as the thing. And what gets in the way of you enjoying your retirement? Are you squeezing out love to pursue your retirement? Are there adult kids that need you? Are there grandkids that need you? Are there other opportunities that you're saying no to because your right and freedom for retirement is rising up? If we took the opposite spectrum, if we took work, we're not retired, we're probably working. If you take work, what does it look like to do work for the glory of God? It's not just work really hard. It's not less than that. But that can't be all that it is. It might be dialing down our rights and our freedom to work hard that it would balance out. And there's a saying in business, in companies, of it's just business. Well, what does that mean? It's not personal. I'm just doing this for something else. Would we do it for the glory of God? Man, maybe we need to put boundaries in our work life that we're present at home, that we're more focused on our kids and our wife. I heard this devastating story about a theologian whose books I have on my shelf. And he wrote a lot of really good things, a lot of deep things about God, but he neglected his family. In fact, his wife ended up divorcing him. And she said, that theologian, he loved God. My new husband loves me. Do you hear the hurt in that? There is a way that we can raise something else, even if it's godly work, where God's splendor and his glory is not seen by other people. Would you use the things in your life to show the splendor of who God is, the radiance, the brilliance, that his goodness would shoot forth in your life? Would you raise your family to the glory of God? Would you use your phones? I don't have my phone. Imagine I had my phone. You have a right and you have the freedom to be on your phone whenever you want. There are times when that's not going to be profitable. If all my kids do is see me on my phone, I am not doing that to the glory of God. Would you use your actions? Would you use your words? Would you use your political stances for the glory of God? Paul says, whatever you do, in all categories, you're to aim, you're to do it to the glory of God. And for this context, Paul draws out two things. He says, give no offense, either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, so that they may be saved. As we evaluate our amoral rights and freedoms, we should not be addressing the question, is it allowable, but is it profitable? Does it edify? Does it build up? He says, not to me, to the many. He talks about the Jews. He talks about the Greeks. He talks about the church of God. That's everybody, right? That's inclusive of everybody in the Corinthians world. I find this verse quite ironic because if you know Paul, he is one of the people that is most documented for not being on people's good sides. He stirs up riots wherever he goes. People stone him to death. They beat him with big rods. There's some Jewish men that make a vow that we're not going to eat or drink until we kill this guy. And yet, yeah, he pleases all men in all things. What is he saying there? Right? Clearly, this is not just people pleasing because he's doing a horrible job at that. He's summarizing what he said in chapter 9. He says, for though I am free from all men, I've made myself a slave to all men, that I may win more. To the Jews, I became a Jew so that I might win Jews. Those under the law as under the law that I may win those under law. Those who are without the law is without the law that I may win those without the law. The weak I became weak, I became all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. He says, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Paul arranges his life. He uses his rights and his freedom for spreading the gospel. He uses it as a leverage tool to springboard into the gospel. He says, I please all men and all things that they may be saved, that they may see God's glory, that they may see the radiance, the brilliance, the splendor of who God is and be drawn into it. before God's wrath rains down. Paul's rights and freedoms are adjusted to who he's around so that they wouldn't be a barrier to the gospel, so that they wouldn't be a barrier to believing in the gospel. This does not mean that he's doing things just so people will like him. If you know Paul, you know that he's not a people pleaser by any means. This does not mean that he has to obey other people's preferences. He's going to write about that in Romans 14. This is not a preferential thing. It's when there is a barrier to the gospel, when exercising his rights and his freedom that he can choose to do or not do, when he does that, if it's going to hurt the gospel, he's not going to do it. He's hands off on it. The gospel will be a stumbling block in and of itself. The reason so many people are angry at Paul are because he's sharing the gospel, not because he's insisting on his rights and his freedom. And Paul's appeal to us is to live in a way that magnifies the Lord. The question is not, am I allowed to do it, but is it profitable? I think there's a bigger question to address, though. If we go back to the cinnamon roll story, I knew that Chelsea was right, and I didn't want to do it. I knew that. There was anger that flared up in me, in which I contained. It's not like I just flew off the handle and got really mad and angry about everything. I contained it, but that didn't create a desire for me to want to do it. I think the bigger problem is, how do we desire to do this? I knew what I should do. I didn't want to do it. I still put the cinnamon rolls back with the help of the Holy Spirit. Put the cinnamon rolls back. But my grumbling tarnished that act. Like, I put it back in such a way that my wife knew the dissatisfaction. I grumbled about it. And I think I stomped off and I muttered something like, man can't even eat a cinnamon roll in his own house. You know, like, okay, Kyle. What do we do? What do we do when we don't care about God's glory? When I want the glory of me? There is something inside all of us that wants to rebel. We want to chase our own glory. We want to lean on our rights and freedom. The last verse Paul gets into for this, he says, be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. What happens when I don't want to do this? How do I do this? I need to look to Jesus. Look, you cannot imitate what you have not focused on. The more complex, the more difficult something is, the more you need to be focused on it to see how it's done. There will be a direct correlation. It will be directly dependent on how much we love and see and value Jesus with how we give our rights and our freedom up. The key to this is the gospel, and it's God's glory. We imitate Paul, who imitates Jesus. Jesus is the better imitation. You look at Jesus, Jesus had all kinds of rights and freedom. He did not stand on his rights and freedom as the thing. You take a look at when Adam and Eve first sinned. He did not use his rights to exercise his wrath and his judgment on them. He dialed it down for the profit of many. If you look at Jesus' right to stay in heaven, he didn't have to come to earth. He didn't have to enter into creation. He could have stayed up in heaven. He empties himself instead. He comes into the humble form of a servant for the profit of many. He doesn't even get to choose like this really cool rich person or something, like an easy, luxurious life. He doesn't give himself really impressive features that people are like, ooh. Isaiah says that he looks like an ordinary man. He gives up those rights and that freedom for an easy, comfortable life for the good of the many. You look at him and his ministry, he doesn't demand that his apostles wash his feet. He washes their feet. He had the right, he had the freedom, he could have, especially in that day and age, let alone the fact that he's creator. He lets it go for the profit of the many. You look at Jesus on the cross, he could have called 10,000 angels down. He could have destroyed all the people that were mocking him, that were spitting on him, that were jeering at him. For the good of the many, he dials down those rights and he stays on the cross so that we would never have to be there. The gospel is that Jesus has taken your sin and my sin, and he has absorbed all of it. You and God are good because of Jesus. There is nothing you need to do except believe that and trust that. How do we let go of our rights? How do we do things to God's glory? We focus on the gospel. We get drawn into God's glory. The more we understand God's love for us, the more we should want to imitate it. The more we'll be able to imitate it. Probably the most embarrassing part in that cinnamon roll story, the thing that really woke me up, this is my last time talking about the cinnamon roll story. I stomped off like a grump. My wife didn't say a word. What she did do was collect all the kids, get them buckled into their seatbelts for school, and then she came back in and she warmed me up a cinnamon roll. And so when I came back down, I saw a cinnamon roll, and it just broke me. I'm like, oh, what am I doing? This is a cinnamon roll. Love cuts through in a way that other things don't. You want to imitate Jesus? You need to see his love for you. You need to see his glory, the goodness, the brilliance, the splendor of who God is. If you want to imitate that. New Hope, would we be a people where our love would go forth even as we dial back our rights and our freedom? Would we not prioritize our glory and our reputation and our rights, but the well-being of someone else? May we do everything to the glory of God. Let me pray. Lord, how good is your glory? That it's always for our good. How good is your glory that you would give everything up for us, that you would be known deeper, that you would save us from ourselves, from the judgment of what we've done. Lord, I pray that you would send your spirit and you would stir things up in our hearts. We have rights and we have freedoms that we are reluctant to give up. Would you send your spirit as a conviction to those things? Would we choose your glory and your goodness rather than profaning your name? Where we failed in this, Lord, would you remind us that you love us, that you haven't given up on us, that you're in the mess with us? And would we be quick to turn and confess that we would restore friendship, restore restoration? I thank you for your son, Jesus. I thank you that he is someone that is always worthy of being imitated. I pray that you'd help us in that. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen. It's good to be with you, New Hope. Have a great rest of your Sunday.